Good afternoon from Washington. This is Richard Harkness. The National Broadcasting Company is reporting for you this afternoon one of the most historic events of our post-war world. For here today, in the Department of Labor Auditorium in the capital of the United States, 12 Western nations are signing the North Atlantic Pact, the North Atlantic Defense Alliance. Right at this moment, President Truman, who has just come into the hall, is speaking to the assembled body of foreign ministers, ambassadors to Washington, and dignitaries of the diplomatic and official life from around the world, and now the President of the United States.
To maintain international peace and security, each is bound to settle international disputes by peaceful means, to refrain from the threat or use of force against the territory or independence of any country, and to support the United Nations in any action it takes to preserve the peace. That solemn pledge, that abiding obligation, we reaffirm here today. We rededicate ourselves to that obligation and propose this North Atlantic Treaty as one of the means to carry it out. Through this treaty, we undertake to conduct our international affairs in accordance with the provisions of the United Nations Charter. We undertake to exercise our right of collective or individual self-defense against armed attack in accordance with Article 51 of the Charter, and subject to such measures as the Security Council may take to maintain and restore international peace and security. Within the United Nations, this country and other countries have hoped to establish an international force for the use of the United Nations in preserving peace throughout the world. Our efforts to establish this force, however, have been blocked by one of the major powers. This lack of unanimous agreement in the Security Council does not mean that we must abandon our attempts to make peace secure. Even without that agreement, which we still hope for, we shall do as much as we can. And every bit that we do will add to the strength of the fabric of peace throughout the world. In this treaty, we seek to establish freedom from aggression and from the use of force in the North Atlantic community. This is the area which has been at the heart of the last two world conflicts. To protect this area against war will be a long step toward permanent peace in the whole world. There are those who claim that this treaty is an aggressive act on the part of the nations which ring the North Atlantic. That is absolutely untrue. The pact will be a positive, not a negative influence for peace. And its influence will be felt not only in the area it specifically covers, but throughout the world. Its conclusion does not mean a narrowing of the interests of its members. Under my authority and instructions, the Secretary of State has recently made it perfectly clear that the adherence of the United States to this pact does not signify a lessening of American concern for the security and welfare of other areas of the world, such as the Near East. The step we're taking today should serve to reassure peace-loving peoples everywhere and pave the way for the worldwide stability and peaceful development which we all seek. Twice in recent years, nations have felt the sickening blow of unprovoked aggression. Our peoples, to whom our governments are responsible, demand that these things shall not happen again. We are determined that they shall not happen again. In taking steps to prevent aggression against our own peoples, we have no purpose of aggression against other peoples. To suggest the contrary is to slander our institutions and defame our ideals and our aspirations. The nations represented here are bound together by ties of long standing. We're joined by a common heritage of democracy, individual liberty, and rule of law. These are the ties of a peaceful way of life. In this pact, we are merely giving them formal recognition. with our common traditions, we face common problems. We are, to a large degree, industrial nations, and we face the problem of mastering the forces of modern technology in the public interest. To meet this problem successfully, we must have a world in which we can exchange the products of our labor, not only among ourselves, but with other nations. We've come together in a great cooperative economic effort to establish this kind of world. We're determined to work together to provide better lives for our people without sacrificing our common ideals of justice and human worth. But we cannot succeed if our people are haunted by the constant fear of aggression and burdened by the cost of preparing their nations individually against attack. In this pact, we hope to create a shield against aggression and the fear of aggression, a bulwark which will permit us to get on with the real business of government and society, the business of achieving a fuller and happier life for all our citizens. We shall, no doubt, go about this business in different ways. There are different kinds of governmental and economic systems, just as there are different languages and different cultures. But these differences present no real obstacle to the voluntary association of free nations devoted to the common cause of peace. We believe that it is possible for nations to achieve unity on the great principles of human freedom and justice, and at the same time to permit in other respects the greatest diversity of which the human mind is capable. Our faith in this kind of unity is borne out by our experience here in the United States in creating one nation out of the variety of our continental resources and the peoples of many lands. This method of organizing diverse peoples and cultures is in direct contrast to the method of the police state, which attempts to achieve unity by imposing the same beliefs and the same rule of force on everyone. We believe that our method of achieving international unity through the voluntary association of different countries dedicated to a common cause is an effective step toward bringing order to our troubled world. For us, war is not inevitable. We do not believe that there are blind tides of history which sweep men one way or another. In our own time, we've seen brave men overcome obstacles that seemed insurmountable and forces that seemed overwhelming. Men with courage and vision can still determine their own destiny. They can choose slavery or freedom, war or peace. I have no doubt which they will choose. The treaty we are signing here today is evidence of the path they will follow. If there is anything certain today, if there is anything inevitable in the future, it is the will of the people of the world for freedom and for peace.
A rising, cheering ovation for President Truman following his brief speech here in the Department of Labor Auditorium in Washington, a speech to mark the signing of the historic North Atlantic Pact. And now the voice of Secretary of State.
We will now proceed to the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty. The names of the signatory states will be called in their alphabetical order in the English language.
The State Department functionary will call the name of each country. The foreign minister will descend from the upper platform to a long, low, oaken desk and there attach the signature, his signature for his country, to this defense alliance aimed primarily against Russia. The foreign ministers, 12, are sitting in a semicircle on a stage decorated with the spring beauties of ferns and greenery and hydrangeas. The ceremony started here this
afternoon.
Belgium. Country of Belgium. The little country of Belgium, a victim of aggression in World War I and II, is the first to sign.
His Excellency
this
Paul Henri Spaak.
Honor and
Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs of Belgium.
The honor and responsibility of dignified Paul-Henri Spaak, the Belgian Foreign Minister and also Premier. I saw almost 4 years ago Spaak sign the United Nations Charter at San Francisco. And he's here now signing his country into this new defensive alliance because United Nations has been kept from working, has been kept from working by Russia, a charge which has been made here this afternoon over and over again by each foreign minister. Now, Paul-Henri Spaak is a frank man. He told Andrei Vyshinsky of Russia at the UN meeting not so long ago that the work of the Communist Party makes the fifth columns of Nazism look like Boy Scout troops. An ovation.
Canada.
It is now the turn of Canada.
The Honorable Lester B. Pearson, Secretary of State for External Affairs of Canada.
Also, Ambassador Hume Wrong will sign the treaty. Now, Mr.
Excellency Hume Wrong, Ambassador of Canada.
He takes his seat with his good right arm, signs the treaty. The French, or I should say the Canadian Foreign Minister, Mr. Pearson, is the former ambassador to Washington, where he was known simply and with a respect of friendship as
Denmark. Mike.
Denmark is the number three of the signatory nations. The Danish Foreign Minister,
Gustav Rasmussen, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Denmark.
He is signing now, Mr. Rasmussen, and then will come the Danish ambassador. Now, each foreign minister and his ambassador have a moment at the table under the bright Klieg lights of the newsreels before the batteries of radio microphones and television cameras. And now the ambassador.
Hendrik de Kaufman, ambassador of Denmark.
Now, the scratching of their pens is being recorded by one of the largest radio networks in history. The American Broadcasting Systems, the British Broadcasting Corporation, Canadian Broadcasting, the Armed Services Radio, and the Voice of America. Well, that laugh comes up because the Danish ambassador, Mr. D. Kaufman, asked for the pen with which he signed this historic pact. Here is the first major power to sign, France. The applause for the Foreign Minister, Robert Schuman.
His Excellency, Robert Schuman, Minister of Foreign Affairs of the French Republic.
Schumann is a tall, balding man of 72 years of age, here today to sign this historic Charter Defense Alliance.
His Excellency Henri Bonnet, Ambassador of the French Republic.
A veteran diplomat from the old world here in Washington signs for his country. He rises, bows. State Department aide wipes off the pen and presents it to the ambassador, carefully blocks the signature on the treaty. Now, Iceland. The foreign minister is young, 41-year-old Bjarni Benediktsson.
The Honorable Bjarni Benediktsson, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Iceland.
Now, Iceland signing is a small yet strategic country in the defense of the North Atlantic. Country or airfields in case of aggression to stave off attack by submarines. Iceland becomes, in spite of her size, an important member of the nations
of
the
West. The Honorable Tor Tors, Minister of Iceland.
A fine Icelandic-looking figure of a man takes the pen, writes in a rather large scrawl, Tor Tors, Iceland.
Italy.
Pact. Tall, dignified looking representative of Italy counts for some. 75 years old, a leader against communism. He leans over to shake hands with Vice President Bartley.
Minister of Foreign Affairs of Italy.
He adjusts his reading glasses. No hesitancy. A smile on his face. A handsome man with a small white goatee. And he takes his copy of the pen.
His Excellency Alberto Tarchiani, Ambassador of Italy.
Italy is the sixth country to sign the North Atlantic Pact. There will be 12 signatories, nations all together here this afternoon. He lifts his glasses, puts them up on his forehead as he signs. Applause. And his pen. He readjusts his glasses. Smile on his face. He goes back to his seat on the upper platform.
Luxembourg.
Now, this is the moment in the glare of worldwide publicity for tiny Luxembourg.
His Excellency Joseph Besch, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Luxembourg.
Now, Luxembourg is a small and helpless country. Now, what is she doing in this agreement? Well, Luxembourg is one of the Benelux countries. She's been in step with this making of Western European unity since the Pact of Brussels in March 48.
The Honorable 48. Hugh Le Gallais, Minister of Luxembourg.
The Minister Hugh Gallais. The gentleman who just signed for Luxembourg, Joseph Besch, is 62. Open and long-time advocate of Western cooperation for peace and development. One of the smallest nations to sign the pact. A wipe of the pen presented to the two signatories from Luxembourg.
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands. Well, there comes to the signing table now the foreign minister of the Netherlands, Dirk Sticker. The Dutch ambassador is the former foreign minister.
His Excellency D.U. Sticker, Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Netherlands.
Ambassador Ilko van Kleffens. Van Kleffens is a diplomatic veteran of San Francisco, where he signed the United Nations Charter for the Netherlands. We might point out that the Netherlands is involved now before the UN because of Indonesia.
His Excellency E.N. Van Kleffens, Ambassador of the Netherlands.
A tall, balding man, light in color. He tries out his pen with a few preliminary squiggles before he puts his signature upon this historic document. Signing this agreement of regional security for Western Europe and the North Atlantic.
Norway.
Now here is the greatest show of national courage in this entire ceremony, because Norway signed the Atlantic Pact under warning of Russia.
His Excellency Halvard M. Lange, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Norway.
Halvard Lange signs for his country. And then the ambassador, Norwegian ambassador, Wilhelm D. Morgenstern. Now, a bit of Norway borders on Russia, you know. And Moscow told Norway, in so many words, do not sign with the West.
His Excellency Wilhelm Munthe de Morgensterne, ambassador of Norway.
But here are the little country's two top diplomats signing this anti-communistic agreement. Norway's signature is important from the standpoint of defense, for Norway has a coastline dotted with fjords, and from these fjords, in case of war, could come aggressive submarines to prey on Allied shipping in the North Atlantic. The West has in Norway a small but mighty friend, and there's the friendly ovation.
Portugal.
The two representatives of Portugal approach the table. José da Mata, the Portuguese foreign minister.
His Excellency Dr. José Caeiro da Mata, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Portugal.
And the Ambassador Pedro Pereira. Now, it is difficult to think of Portugal as a nation of the North Atlantic. The North Atlantic extends for the purpose of this treaty, however, from the Tropic of Cancer north.
His Excellency Pedro Teotonio Pereira, Ambassador of Portugal.
Now, da Mata has Portugal bound closely to Spain. Generalissimo Franco is not here for Spain today, but he has hinted broadly that Spain would like to be included in this Western Pact against aggression. Portuguese Ambassador, tall, distinguished-looking gentleman. John Foley of the State Department wipes off the pen with his diplomatic pen wiper.
the United Kingdom.
Now there walks to the table, to the cheers, the British Foreign Minister, Ernest Bevin.
The British Right Honorable Ernest Bevin.
And next, the British Ambassador, former professor at Oxford, Sir Oliver Franks. Now, Bevin is that queer diplomatic combination of former dock worker and world statesman. He was orphaned at six. He grew up working with his hands, and now around the conference table of the world.
His Excellency Sir Oliver Franks, British Ambassador.
A tall, very, very British-looking gentleman. One cannot help but compare today that short, stocky figure of Bevin and the former British Foreign Secretary, the suave and dapper Anthony Eden. Britain, one of the main signatories of the pact, and now completing the ceremony,
the United States of America.
Secretary of State, Dean Anderson. Ask President Truman to come to the table with him. President reaches over, shakes hands with Vice President Barclay. Mr. Truman takes Barclay's arm, picks him up, and makes him step up on the platform. All the ovation, the President, the Vice President, and the Secretary of State.
The Honorable Dean Acheson, Secretary of State.
Mr. Acheson sits at the desk with President Truman and Vice President Barclay. Looking over his right shoulder, Mr. Acheson makes that preliminary test of his pen and now signs for the United States of America. And thus, the signing is completed formally. The President and Vice President shake hands. Vice President steps over a velvet rope down to his seat in the front row. The President of the United States, followed by the Secretary of State, go to their seats on the upper platform. Secretary of State.
Under the terms of the treaty, the signatory powers are called upon to ratify in accordance with their respective constitutional processes. The treaty shall enter into force between the states which have ratified it as soon as the ratifications of the majority of the signatories, including the ratifications of Belgium, Canada, France, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, and the United States, have been deposited and shall come into effect with respect to other states at the date of the deposit of their ratifications. This concludes the ceremonies. I request all to remain in their places until the President, the Vice President, and their Excellencies, the Foreign Ministers, have departed.
And thus, the ceremony is concluded at the signing of the North Atlantic Pact. The Marine Orchestra plays for President Truman to leave the Department of Labor Auditorium on Constitution Avenue here in Washington, D.C. Let's listen to the music for a moment. Defense Alliance Agreement. The North Atlantic Pact is short. It runs 1,040 words. Now each member pledges, in the case another is attacked from without or within, to go to that country's aid. It is then mainly a defensive alliance. But it means, to have full effect, an American arms aid program to Great Britain, France, Italy, the Scandinavian countries, which had their foreign ministers present today. Oh, I heard Mr. Ernest Bevin, the foreign minister of Britain, outline the meaning of this treaty as he spoke at the National Press Club. Mr. Bevin said this. He said, there will be a common pool of manpower, military assistance, economic assistance, and the rest of it. He said, we bring together freedom in one common organism. We shall respect each other. We shall teach others to respect us. Mr. Bevin states the aims of the North Atlantic Pact clearly. He minces no words. I should like to tell you that the treaty itself, which was signed here this afternoon,
is a most imposing-looking document. It is typed, for instance, on special treaty paper. Each sheet is 10 inches by 14. Each page is etched with gold. Now, there is even protocol for the ribbon which decorates an international agreement such as this. It works this way. If we sign a treaty with a kingdom, the State Department uses red. An agreement with another republic or a dictatorship calls for blue ribbon. Well, this North Atlantic Pact is, of course, multilateral. That is, it is being signed this afternoon by several nations. Well, that calls for the State Department's multilateral ribbon, which is red, white, and blue. Now, if we think of the North Atlantic Pact on the basis of strength, it gives the world an almost even balance of power between the East and our West. Russia has, in the Red Army, or in satellite armies, almost 5 million armed men. This North Atlantic Pact unites nations in the West with 4.5 million troops. But we do have the advantage of industrial development, our technical know-how of production, and the weapon held by the United States, the atomic bomb. Now, it remains, of course, for the United States Senate to ratify the North Atlantic Pact. There will be debate. There will be a discussion whether this agreement preserves for Congress the constitutional right to declare war. But the consensus is now the Senate will ratify by the necessary two-thirds majority. It should be reported, however, that there is a split in the Senate over the arms program to follow the pact. Senator George of Georgia says, for instance, that we may have to send American troops to Western Europe to garrison these other countries which have signed the pacts today. It may be, then, when the North Atlantic Pact comes up in the United States Senate, which should be shortly, Senator George may offer a reservation. Incidentally, there's a little interesting note from these proceedings today if you are superstitious. President Truman was the 13th speaker at this ceremony today. Now, he's being preceded by the foreign ministers of the 12 signatory countries. But the State Department said that 13 is as good as any other number, so Mr. Truman addressed the ceremony in that order as you heard him over our National Broadcasting Company network. Well, the North Atlantic Pact was signed, of course, over the express protest of Russia. The foreign ministers met privately last Saturday. They voted unanimously to turn down the Russian protest. Hence, we saw today that the ambassador to Washington from Moscow, Andrei Panushkin, boycotted this ceremony. The National Broadcasting Company has reported from Washington the signing of the historic North Atlantic Pact. 12 nations have banded together today to meet mutually any attack of aggression from without or within. They have rebuffed in this signing the direct protest of Soviet Russia. Now, the formalizing of the North Atlantic Pact has taken place in the departmental auditorium of the Department of Labor in the Capitol. 12 nations from Belgium alphabetically through the United States of America have become signatory countries to this mutual defense alliance against any possible communistic aggression. Now, this was only the ceremony, but it means now the productive power, the fighting power of the West, pitted against what we know as the aggressive ambitions of the East. This is Richard Harkness, your NBC reporter in Washington. And now, from the nation's capital, good afternoon.